you know, I'll interact with a lot of public speakers because that's a big part of my business. And I see there's so many that are charming and funny and fun and smart. And then I go on Twitter and they've just automated away their personality. And I don't automate. I interact. I share strongly worded opinions. I try to poke the bear, whatever the bear is, something that's bothering me in marketing. And those statements, void of a link, tend to get a lot of response. So that once in a while, when I post a link, I get pretty good click-through.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. There's a lot going on here at InnovaBiz as we get ready for our Vanuatu business retreat in June, which I'm really looking forward to. Now, I'm really also excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Jay Akunzo, the founder of Unthinkable Media. He's also an award-winning podcast as host of the Unthinkable podcast. He's a very energetic keynote speaker that'll come across in the interview. He's a veteran content marketer. He served as the digital media strategist at Google, head of content at HubSpot, as well as a few other roles before he founded Unthinkable Media. Jay and I covered some key points about producing exceptional content that stands out, including being exceptional and learning from models, understanding their framework and structure, and then building your own off that. We talked about developing an emotional connection to your audience and holding their attention. We talked about the benefits of podcasting and making your podcast the pillar of all your content. And we also talked about why he hates sand. Now, without further ado, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Jay Akunzo. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from New York in the USA, Jay Akunzo, who's the founder of Unthinkable Media. Jay's an award-winning podcaster. He's host of the Unthinkable podcast and also a couple of others. He's an energetic keynote speaker, a veteran content marketer and creator. He's served as digital media strategist at Google. He's been head of content at HubSpot, and he's worked in venture capital companies as well before starting his own business. So welcome to the podcast, Jay. It's a great privilege to have you here.
Oh, that's so nice to you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, your work's also been cited in courses at the Harvard Business School by writers at the New York Times and Washington Post, and by investors on TV's Shark Tank, which is well known to the audience in most places of the world. So I'm really keen to explore the idea of content and being creative in content further with Jay today. Tamsin Webster, who was on episode 116, introduced me to Jay and suggested that we interview you on the podcast. So big hello to Tamsin as well.
Tamsin is great. She's probably one of the smartest minds, if not the smartest mind I know in public speaking.
Yeah, and we had a lot of fun talking to her a couple of weeks ago. So before we talk about content marketing and creativity and how to tell a really good story, let's find out a little bit more about you as a person. So I know you hated sand when you were a young kid, but what did you want to do when you grew up?
Yeah, you're referencing an article, which I assume we'll talk about. And yeah, I hated sand, and it was a funny story, which we'll get to. That's a teaser for the listener. Keep listening, which actually plays into the topic of that article. So when I was a kid, I really wanted to be a sports journalist. I actually went to school in college here in the States for English literature, but I was focused on the side, breaking into sports media any way I could. I wrote for print publications, small and large, local and statewide. I interned at ESPN, which was about 30 minutes away from where I went to college. And so I thought that was going to be my path, which was to work in either print media or digital, which was emerging, as a sports journalist.
And did you
kind of head off in that path?
It's funny. Every so often I think about this. I was about to graduate, and my manager in my internship at ESPN basically like forwarded me a job description, and he said, I'm going to submit this to HR and I want you to apply for it and I will hire you. We had a really great rapport. And I was so excited because that was the dream. I mean, when you're in sports media, especially back then, that was Mecca. You know, I think ESPN's star has fallen a little bit, but back then it was it. And I remember going home where I grew up, back to my parents' house after I graduated. I hadn't heard back from that manager. I kept emailing him, tried calling him a couple of times. And eventually he got back to me and said, I'm sorry, because the economy tanked, we're unable to hire more junior level people. So I get to choose one role only to hire for the next few quarters. And I'm going to hire somebody more senior. And I was devastated. You know, I was the type of student that you're supposed to get great grades. You're supposed to join the clubs and then eventually lead those clubs. You're supposed to have the great polished resume and everything will work out in your favor. So my mind was like not prepared for that scenario.
Yes. My daughter had a similar experience to that. And she ended up not pursuing a law career as a result, but I think, you know, things turned out really well for her. And I believe things are turning out really well for you.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us what led you to Unthinkable Media then. So we talked about your stint at Google and at HubSpot.
Yeah, so that's where I started my career actually, was in digital media strategy at Google. So on a whim, I decided to apply through an online form to Google. And for some unknown reason, they got back to me and they were staffing up their Boston office at the time to hire a lot of young talent out of college in order to build their digital media strategist team, which is essentially this fancy title that meant like internal AdWords experts. So Google AdWords being their, you know, their search, display, and YouTube ad products, and then the mobile versions of all those things. And so I was hired into this kind of confusing sounding role, but Google sounded great. And I took the job, moved to Boston. And the first day on the job, I met my now wife. So that was very fortuitous. I'm glad I took that job. I think I have the best return on investment of a first job ever. Yeah. But it opened my mind and eyes to technology. And it was not a field I thought I would be in. My dad is a software engineer, and he still jokes that he can't believe we talk about all these nerdy things in tech now. But I fell in love. You know, I saw that this is where the world was heading. And, you know, digital media could be a great and very creative career path for me. Unfortunately, at Google, I felt like the creativity was squeezed out of me by nature of the job. You know, it was advisory work, which is fun for some people, but I wasn't able to be strategic enough as a junior level employee to really make it my own. It just didn't feel like creating content, which is what I wanted to do as a writer. And so I remember I had this phone call or email maybe from one of the executives sent out an email to the sales team saying, we need 40 people who care about social media. So this is back in 08 when not many people were on social like Twitter. And we need 40 people globally from the sales team to volunteer to be social media gurus. And I wish that was not the actual title, but it was. And they brought us down to New York, and it was there that this executive kind of presented the vision for where Google saw social heading and where their products would fit in. And that became the infamous Google Plus eventually. But in the near term, I got to go back to my clients and basically just be an educator without agenda. Instead of selling Google products, I got to talk to them about all the things I was tinkering on personally and all the case studies and all the interesting trends happening with social media. And it just worked out that because I wanted to be a sports writer, I had all these side blogs that I just launched for fun and used social media to grow them. And so I got to speak about all these new trends, and I was like, you know what? This is it. This is where it's going. It's going to be social and content together. And so I went to a startup that was specialized in helping brands master social media. And I discovered the phrase content marketing and also launched a community group in Boston about content marketing. So between the startup and the community group, I've not looked back. Like, I've just been in content marketing since then. And I feel like I found this roundabout way to make things for a living, you know, and that's led me all the way to today to running a podcast development company, basically working with brands to host and create and concept shows that are genuinely entertaining about topics relating to work.
Okay, so you've touched a little bit on what Unthinkable Media do. So tell us a little bit more about what you do at Unthinkable Media and also why you do that.
Yeah, let me give you the why first. So I, as an individual, I am entirely too sick of kind of commodity shows about work. I think there's so much intellectual rigor and investment paid to things like the technology or the marketing strategy or the measurement of shows, whether the show is audio or video, but unfortunately not as much paid to the creative. And so when I was working in venture capital, which was a stop right before Unthinkable Media, I was leading their brand and their content and community arms. And my first pet project was to launch a podcast. And I was just trying to mimic my favorite shows, whether it was, you know, one of my favorite shows growing up was Radiolab, which is highly produced, or Bill Simmons, who's a very popular sports columnist. I was just trying to mimic my heroes and then add a little spin to make it my own in a show for work. And it was about work topics. And we got tons of press. And I got a lot of personal attention that I wasn't used to getting, quite frankly, because I was just trying new and different things in podcasting. And I sort of realized, hey, you know, this is an opportunity. You know, I started getting questions from people about how I was doing it. And then I thought to myself, okay, this might be something. So let me try launching my own show where there's no brand attached. It's just my own show. And that became Unthinkable. Let me really go for it. And I started doing all these narrative style stories. I call that show, you know, like my ongoing laboratory for testing new ideas I have about podcasting. And the more I did that show, the more speaking engagements I got, and I became a public speaker full time, and the more clients came my way to try and concoct a show of their own. And so it all stemmed from this disdain that I have about like the boredom you feel with content about work. Because, I mean, you know, personally, I'm sure, like, we experience so much emotion in our careers and we care deeply about the work that we do. And then we consume content about our careers or our industry and it doesn't match that emotional plane. And so I want to fix that. So that's my personal reason for launching Unthinkable Media. And then what we do is we concept, basically creating a show level concept and an episode level structure and host, as in like provide the talent for shows about work with B2B brands.
I love that. It reminds me a little bit because you talked about the depths of emotions that we feel about what we do and why we do it. And clearly, if you have a very powerful why, then those emotions are going to be very powerful. I was doing a presentation I was crewing for my business coach who did some training over the last 10 days. And I did a presentation as part of that. And at the beginning of the presentation, and I knew this would happen, I apologized because I was going to tear up at one point in the presentation because it was a very emotional thing. And she said to me afterwards, she said, stop apologizing for getting emotional. So it's, you know, sharing that depth of emotion is part of making that story different, exceptional, right?
Yeah, no, exactly right. And my personal bias is to create shows that exhibit emotion. And sometimes, yeah, it's somber or deep or sad or even sappy. But a lot of times it's fun and funny. You know, and I think the whole goal is to construct a show. And that's really what I'm fascinated by is like the nuance of a show's construction. But to construct a show that genuinely holds attention, which is what I call the new marketing mandate. Hold attention, don't just acquire it. So if you're going to hold attention, you need to be genuinely enjoyable. And I don't mean kitsch. I don't mean, you know, overly playful when you're selling servers, unless that's something that represents your brand and your audience. Mm. But using all the, you know, kind of deploying all the great techniques from TV and movies and public radio and, you know, terrestrial radio and YouTubers and all these channel-based or series-based approaches to media and content that I don't think the content marketing world has quite figured out yet. You know, usually it's in the realm of like your global brands paying agencies to concoct something that's amazing. And we assume that the only way to create something of that high quality is we have to pay huge amounts of money and have no ROI attached to it whatsoever. And I feel like that's actually not the case. It's about intellectual rigor. It's not just about budget. And so I'm out there teaching this. I'm out there working with clients and doing this. And I'm also out there doing it every week on my personal and client shows that I host. But it's the same thing that woman said. It's like never apologize for finding meaning in your work because, you know, that's what a meaningful career is. You want to find emotion in what you do. And I want shows to reflect that.
Mm. Now, you gave some examples of people that you observed and watched to get inspiration for your shows and for the content you produced. And you talked somewhere in amongst all the stuff that I read about you about understanding the framework and structure of shows or of performances and then building your own framework, structure and content around that. So talk to us a little bit more about that, because I think this is really critical. You mentioned earlier, and you talk a lot about this in all your content, about being different, being exceptional, standing out. And yet a lot of people look at copying others that they admire or that they feel are models, rather than doing what you mentioned in understanding the framework and structure and then building your own on that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things we can put a pin in there, right? It's like, one is, you know, is copying the path to commodity work? It can be if that's all you do, if you stop at copying.
Hmm.
But, and I feel like this is the problem with best practices, it's not about where you start. It's about what else you do after. So like best practices are merely a good place to start, but there's a lot of places to start. You can start with your own idea. You can start with questioning a best practice. You can start with a list article, a podcast. There's many different ways you can start, and we conflate a best practice with a final answer or with the blueprint that we should follow. But the missing pieces of a best practice are all the variables that make your context that specific context. In other words, whatever makes you and that moment and that time, team, customer, et cetera, an exception from the rule, those variables are missing from those rules, from those best practices. So when you go and copy somebody's show, if you then never take into account the fact that that host is hilarious and you're very dry, mm-hmm. or you never take into account that that host speaks to audience X and you speak to audience Y, or you have far fewer resources, or like me, you have a dog that barks constantly outside your door. Whatever the case is, like, your situation has a lot of variables that best practices and or experts have not taken into consideration when they profess to have the answers. So I think it's a far better skill to know how to find your own. And you can apply that philosophy to anything. I try to apply that to building shows. And so one way I do that is, if I'm working with a client or I'm concocting my own program, I start with something I admire and I perform what I call an extraction. And so I'll give you an example. Anthony Bourdain's TV show, Parts Unknown, one of the best travel shows, one of the best storytellers. What I think he does so well is something I'd like to be good at too, which is he pulls out meaningful stories from people's day-to-day. You know, he finds meaning in the seemingly mundane. And I'm trying to do that all the time because I'm talking about work and career and business and topics that stereotypically people associate with boringness. And so, or roteness, redundancy. So I want to have that skill set. Okay, when I started my podcast, I watched his show and I tried to document minute by minute what did he achieve in a single episode. Basically, I pulled out what they call in TV the blocks and the beats. So minute 0 to 5 was the opening. He did this. Here are the pieces of this. And I tried to come up with a framework stolen from his show. And then when I went and executed that on my end, I didn't have a word-for-word copycat approach. I didn't use the same questions he interviewed people with. No. But I did have the purpose of the opening was X. And to get to X, try these 5 tactics. And I threw out the tactics that didn't work for me and installed my own. I basically had like a framework or guardrails and goalposts, but then I still had to play the game. I had to put on the uniform and get in the game, and it was me doing all the work. So if I just stopped at my favorite show is similar to his and I copied it and gave no more thought to it, yeah, I'm going to be a commodity. But then if I'm willing to add in some self-awareness and some situational awareness about myself, my audience, and my resources, now I'm going to create something original. And I think that's a great way to use inspirational sources, not as a crutch. You know, it's standing on the shoulders of giants, not leaning against them like a crutch.
Hmm. That's great advice. It's a really great approach. I like it. How do you then know that it's resonating with your audience?
When it comes to podcasts specifically?
Yeah, when let's say you've implemented that framework and structure that you've modeled off that TV show, that travel show, I can't remember its name, but you've modeled it off that, you've built your own around that, and then you present that. How do you then know, yes, that worked, or no, that didn't quite hit the mark?
Yeah, I'm constantly on the hunt for resonance. I think resonance makes all the other stuff we want easier, like reach and conversions and loyalty and all that stuff. Resonance. And so how do you measure resonance? It's really tough. You can measure things like time spent, but that can be tricky, especially in audio. So what I look for is I actually made up an acronym for this fake metric, because if you don't have an acronym, people in business don't take you seriously. So here's my acronym. URR. It stands for unsolicited response rate. And essentially what I want is I want to see a small number of people I don't know, people that are not my friends and family, a small number of people reacting in a big way to something that I put out into the world. And if I get that signal, I'm going to lean into that harder. And you can do this whether you're trying something out in a project, whether it's a product or content, or you can do this when you're going to market with the project. So if I'm building a project, I can put out the first episode and then see, did anybody comment? Did it work? Were people strongly and emotionally and viscerally reacting to this thing or not? If not, I need to take a radically new approach the next time and then try to continue to whittle down and refine from there. If they did, that's interesting. That's signal. I should explore that more. I should try to do whatever comments I got, if they referenced the opening, okay, I should try to continually improve my opens. If I didn't get any concrete feedback, it was just like celebratory messages, I need to spend time with these people and ask them questions, or people like them. And so as a result, I do 5 to 6 video calls, one-to-one calls every month with my listeners, which has been transformative for my shows. But I'm looking for resonance. I'm looking for in projects I create. And then when I go to market, I'm like going to put out a little tweet. Here's my idea. Here's a strongly worded opinion. Did anybody respond? Yes. Okay, great. I'm going to turn the tweet into an article. Then I'm going to turn the article, if people respond, into an episode. And then I'm going to go back down that ladder. Here's the episode in blog form. Here's the episode in tweet form. And so it's like you can constantly use the passion of who you're trying to reach as a gauge for whether or not you should invest more in that thing. But unfortunately, I think we're too consumed with big top line results right away. If you just flip that and get the passion first, the big results tend to get a lot easier.
Oh, there's so much I love about that. That is the creative way to do content repurposing. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion online around content repurposing. And I think the bland way to do it is basically just post the same thing in the different media. Maybe change the words or spin it. You know, there's a lot of spinning software out there that people use and it just gets really boring, but that is a really smart way to do it. I love it.
Yeah. If you think of like social channels as one example and you think of them as like offline clubs, if your club is a casual club where people are dressed down and they're having fun and they're, you know, it's boisterous in there and somebody walks in a suit, they're going to seem out of place. But if it's a fancier club, they're right at home. That's social media. It's like, or any channel really. It's like you have to kind of tailor something. You can't just put it in a bunch of places as is. You have to tailor the thing to work on that channel. And there's a great way to see if you're tailoring it correctly, which is, do I get a strong response? If the answer is no, there's a couple things you can investigate further. One is, okay, was it what I'm saying? In other words, was it the topic? Was it the positioning of that topic? Okay, I didn't explain myself well here. Or, and this is a little bit, I think, underused in marketing, is it that this is actually the correct way to say this thing, but not here? This is better suited for LinkedIn instead of Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, a really good example is link sharing. You know, I'll interact with a lot of public speakers because that's a big part of my business. And I see there's so many that are charming and funny and fun and smart. And then I go on Twitter and they've just automated away their personality. And I don't automate. I interact. I share strongly worded opinions. I try to poke the bear, whatever the bear is, something that's bothering me in marketing. And those statements, void of a link, tend to get a lot of response. So that once in a while, when I post a link, I get pretty good click-through. But the ones that are just every hour on the hour sharing a blog post, I see almost no engagement on. And so that's an example of like the topic is probably relevant. The way they're articulating it is probably relevant, but now they feel too buttoned up for Twitter, which is more the water cooler style club or channel. So I think if you came at your distribution of content through that lens and you used the visceral response or total silence of your audience, and again, it can just be a small number of people that respond, but if you use the passionate responses of people as a guide, I think you're on the right track towards mastering a channel or a type of content.
Great advice. So I'd like to explore a little bit more about the idea of holding attention. You talk about, you know, if you're concerned about standing out above the noise and you complain about the noise, you're not actually addressing the problem. And the problem is holding that attention. Now, it's all good and well to focus on holding that attention, but what's your advice on how do you actually get the attention to start with? So if somebody's in a place where they're just not getting any attention, how do you capture that attention to start with? You know, bearing in mind that you're putting out there stuff that, well, once you get the attention, you actually hold the attention because it really is exceptional.
Right, right. So I think it's a combination of relevancy and unexpectedness. So relevancy is, you know, you can do that through organic or paid. I understand my audience. I've actually interacted with the people I'm trying to serve with whatever I'm putting out into the world, which is an underutilized thing as well, as bizarre as that seems, actually talking to customers. I grew up in the tech startup world where the only way to succeed was to constantly do customer development, meet with audience members, meet with users, observe them, record them working through your product, ask them questions about their lives, not yourself. That was gospel. And then I get out into the kind of larger business world as a solo creator now, and it's not something people have adopted, which is, to me, the height of insanity because you're kind of operating blind. So understanding the customer, understanding what's relevant to them, what problem you're trying to solve for them or what desire you're trying to fulfill, that's the fundamental stuff. You know, and then the incremental stuff is like, where do I put that, right? And there's infinite places. You can target audiences on Facebook through using their targeting software. You can string up a couple of blog posts and email it to people. There's all these ways to start getting in front of people and, again, gauging whether or not you're on the right track in terms of relevancy. But then the unexpectedness. So like having a hook. So I'll give you a really specific example. You know, if you see 17 tips and tricks for how to develop an audience, you've seen that article 70 different times from 70 different companies. But if I were to take an anti-stance, why you shouldn't spend any time developing an audience at all, now I stand out, right? Mm. So like noise is not the problem. Sameness is. Because I've published something again to add to the noise, but it's different. It's like if everybody's playing the piano and I start playing electric guitar in the same room, I have a greater chance of getting noticed. So there's terrible ways to do this, which is like leaping out in front of people and screaming at them, which is a lot of hucksters in marketing are doing that today. But then there's good ways to notice. Where is my audience actually not being served? What are they hearing all the time? Do I have a different and strongly worded point of view on that thing? You know, so a really specific example comes from when I launched Unthinkable. I wrote an article called How to Work in Marketing When You're Bothered by Suck. And it was a smash hit because I think I was overtly calling out a lot of things that marketers deal with and kind of bury their inner voice that says, ooh, this is kind of spammy. Why are we doing it that way? And they rationalize it because results, because it just works, because my boss. And I was like, no, there's a better way. Let's explore that. I'm going to make a show. Come along for the ride. And had I not written that article, if I just said, you know, the top 5 content marketing podcasts and mine was number 5, people have seen that a million times before. I wouldn't stand out. So again, I think it's about to acquire attention. It's about the overlap of being incredibly relevant to an audience and then providing value in an unexpected way, whether it's the positioning of the thing, the medium, the way you articulate it. You know, having a strong point of view is about the easiest way that I can come up with, but relevancy overlapped with unexpectedness, that's how you acquire attention.
Yeah, that's great advice. Really like that. And of course, there's some fundamental things that came through with that. And the first one is serving your audience. So where are they not being served and finding the gap there? Knowing who your audience is and knowing where they hang out. So where can you find them to talk to? So I think those are really key points that came out of that for me, as well as the being unexpected and being different.
Yeah, I got an interesting question after a speech a couple of weeks ago. I was in Nashville and someone asked me, when you're in a boring industry, how do you create interesting content? And I understood what they were saying, which is like, you know, compared to, you know, an apparel company or sports media, or, you know, for me, I can create anything I want on my show because I don't have any stakeholders. It's like, I get what they were saying. It's sort of like comparing that stuff to their work. Their work seemed boring. But then it's like, all right, but you're serving this audience. I think they were in some sort of financial services business. And in the content you create, you're trying to solve a problem either by educating those people or providing, you know, a template or something valuable to that person. That's interesting to them, right? I think what they were revealing is either I'm not interested in the job personally, which is a problem, or I haven't spent time with customers to understand what's bugging them, what they're struggling with. Because if you provide something to solve that, it doesn't matter if it's in a boring sector or the most exciting and sexy sounding, you know, pop culture related business, it's going to be interesting to the audience.
Mm. That's right. So key is to know who the audience is, to know what their real needs are, which, as you say, that's interesting to them. And then addressing those in a way that's exceptional and not average.
Right, right. And the way to do that, I think, you know, there's a million ways, but what I'm exploring in my upcoming book called Break the Wheel is how to use the details of your situation. In other words, how to act like an investigator to kind of root out what is it about my team? What is it about my customers? You know, how can I experiment more creatively given the restraints of my resources? But what is it about my context that contains details that are different than the generic advice in the space? You know, so like if you're one of my favorite examples is a coffee brand called Death Wish Coffee. And even the name starts to give you an idea that they're different. They have black and red logos and they have skull and crossbones as their icon. And, you know, they profess to be the world's strongest coffee. And the way they came at this brand wasn't just becoming a rebel for the sake of it. The founder, Mike Brown, was talking to a bunch of his customers and he realized they kept asking the same question, which was they wanted stronger and darker coffee. Now, I don't know how many coffee nerds out there understand this. I certainly didn't when I heard this story. If you roast a bean of coffee long enough that it becomes a dark roast, it has lost much of its caffeine content. Mm. So lighter roasts actually have more caffeine. So you can't really get strong and dark together, except for this type of bean called Robusta coffee, which is largely frowned upon in the coffee space. So all the best practices say, don't roast Robusta, roast something called Arabica. But Mike willingly roasted this bean that was sort of counter the convention because he was just paying more attention to his customers. He was like, look, they are blue collar, hardworking people. They don't care about the artisanal flavors of coffee. They might as well have a Red Bull in the morning. What they're after is the caffeine. They want something dark and strong. And Robusta, when you roast it, yields more caffeine than Arabica. So I'm going to go with that. So that's a way that he became exceptional. He didn't like concoct it in theory. He got out of theory and started investigating his own situation. And that led him to a better answer than any best practice that he found, quite frankly.
Yeah. And I've just opened up the website for Death Wish Coffee.
It's incredible.
It certainly stands out. And I've got some blog posts here that is coffee before bed a bad idea. Well, that's kind of challenging a widely held belief. And then the 10 people you see at a coffee shop, everyone has a price, the Million Dollar Man and the greatest wrestling match of all time, which what's that got to do with coffee?
They don't sell coffee. They sell the ability to work yourself to death.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I'll have to explore that some more afterwards. Okay. I've gone off track here with coffee.
No, that's okay. Can we talk about holding attention really quick? Because I feel like we're really acquiring it. Hmm. And we teased this at the beginning of the show, which was this idea of like me hating sand. So I'll give you the story quick because it explains this idea of holding attention. When I was a kid, my parents tell this story. I would go to the beach and they would put me down on a blanket and I would not leave the blanket. It was like an invisible fence. No matter how many toys were near me or interesting things that you put in my mouth or play with or how many kids were around me, I would stay put on that blanket because apparently I hated sand. And the analogy is everywhere I look in marketing, I continue to hate sand because I see marketers constantly digging holes in dry sand. You know, picture what happens when you dig a hole in dry sand. It just keeps collapsing in on itself. It's not very productive work. Nothing sticks. So we're so focused on acquisition of names, of traffic, of everything, of sales. We're so acquisition heavy in how we think that it's like digging a hole in dry sand. It's like constant motion, or if we stop, nothing works. So it's, if you acquire a bunch of people's attention, they keep hitting your site, throw a bunch of listeners against your podcast is one example, and nobody listens to the whole episode, or nobody subscribes, or nobody comes back, you haven't really succeeded in your work as a marketer. It's not enough to get impressions. We don't sell ad space. We need to get an actual time period where someone spends that time with us. And this is a new muscle, I think. So I wrote an article recently called The New Marketing Mandate. And the whole idea was, it used to be the case that our mandate as marketers was to acquire attention. There were a few channels and very few choices for products and services in a given niche. And so the audience was kind of captive, and you could jump out in front of them 7 to 8 times over the span of, I don't know, a few months, and just keep talking about yourself until they bought. But today, that doesn't work. That's broken. You have to hold attention because the consumer has all the power. There's infinite choice, infinite supply. So the demand side has the control. There's multiple screens, and there's all this technology to get around messages you don't want to hear. And so unless you're able to deliver value over time, holding attention, and by the way, a show is a great way to hold attention, you're not being productive as a marketer. You're digging a hole in dry sand. As soon as you stop your work, everything goes away. Everything dries up. So that's why I hate sand. That's the reveal from the earlier tease of our show. Yeah. And by the way, leading with a tease in a show is a great way to hold attention. Yeah. So it's come full circle. This is a very meta answer for you.
All right, great. Well, thanks for clearing that up. I kind of got stuck on the coffee there. I haven't had my morning coffee yet, so that would kind of sent my mind into a different direction. But thanks for clearing up the sand analogy for us. And what I did want to ask was more about podcasts, because I know you have a number of shows, and one of them is very much an experimental one, and I can't recall the name of it at the moment. I don't have it up here. It's the laboratory where you test things out, and presumably you follow what you told us before, the unsolicited response rate and interviewing listeners to find out what's working there. And I know you also have people on your staff that help you do that. Talk to us a little bit about podcasting as the pillar for all of your content. I mean, I love podcasting. I'm a huge fan of doing a podcast. I really enjoy doing it. I love talking to people. It gets me meeting a lot of people in the online world all around the world. But a lot of people don't want to get on radio, and they don't understand the benefits of it. They might be consumers of podcasts, but they don't necessarily see the value.
Yeah, which is a shame, because I feel like, you know, it is indeed a performance. I think you have to, what is podcast if not being on a microphone with your voice? So I think it's an insane thing to do to start a podcast if you're not comfortable on a microphone. There's many ways to get the same benefits, but I think in this vehicle, it's a new type of benefit that marketers have not typically thought through when it comes to most content marketing. I'd say some organizations that do it well have already tried to think through this type of content. But essentially, when you think of the benefits of podcasting compared to other mediums, so think of blogging versus podcasting as a simple analogy. Most people treat their podcast like an audio blog, but I think that's fundamentally flawed, because text-based content is built for spread. It's great to share. It's easy to share. It's great to discover. It's easy to discover. You know, it's got social media and search. Audio is well behind both the shareability and the discoverability of text. And so they don't quite do the same things for a business, because audiences don't interact with them the same way. So I think instead of thinking like a net new growth engine to reach a massive audience, I think what it does is it takes the few people that you do reach, or the people that you're already reaching, an existing audience, and it turns them to super fans, makes them legitimate friends because they hear your voice. So it's sort of like intimacy that scales. And it's a great complement to all the other stuff you're doing to acquire attention, all the content that's good for reach and spread, because it provides resonance. So I say that there's always 4 distinct benefits to podcasts. You create super fans because you know, URL fans feel like IRL connections. People online feel like they know you offline. When I give a talk and I come off the stage, people approach me like I'm an old friend. And I'm like, then I feel like an idiot. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot who this person was. I'm that guy. Oh no, like I should know this person. And then it's like, oh no, I listen to your podcast, Jay. And it's like simultaneous relief and joy. Cause I'm like, this is amazing. I've never had people hug me because of an article or a tweet. So they create super fans. Podcasts can also like spark movements because you can own a theme outright. If you have an angle on your show, nobody else can copy that. You can own a message, own a moment or a movement. It's very common for people to copy articles. It's very obvious when someone copies a show. So it's sort of like an unassailable asset. It fuels the rest of your marketing. That's the third benefit because a show has all this content bottled up in a single episode. Hmm. You can syndicate it. You can take out lessons. You can use it to inspire new ideas. But I think it fuels all your other channels with endless amounts of content. You know, bloggers act like this all the time. They do interviews that they record for text purposes. Well, what's an audio? What's a podcast? Yeah. It's not an audio file, right? And then the last and fourth benefit is, and this is, I think, the key for marketers, especially selling in a podcast, it triggers actions. So I don't think a podcast addresses one piece of the marketing funnel. I think it straightens the whole damn thing. You know what? Because when you combine a lot of time spent with the intimacy of voice, the result is an audience that feels like they know you, you know, as if in the real world. And how much easier would marketing be if you just marketed to people who actually knew you? Yeah. You know, I think that is the benefit of a great show. That's the benefit of holding attention over time. You know, I get 45 minutes a week with my listeners. How much do marketers usually spend for 45 seconds? So a great show doesn't sit anywhere in the funnel. It straightens the whole thing.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a really succinct summary of all of the benefits or a lot of the benefits of podcasting, but put in a way that it's within the environment and structure of total content marketing initiative. So I love it. All right. Well, this has been great. I'd like to keep on talking for ages, but I'm respectful of your time. And I'd like to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's designed to help our audience that are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. And I've got five questions and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that will inspire everyone to go do something awesome, not that you haven't already done so. So first one is, what's the number one thing anyone needs to be to do to be more innovative?
Spend more time focusing on your firsthand experience of the world. So your self-awareness, your situational awareness. And by that, I mean, get to know yourself and your team, get to know your customers, and understand how to test and iterate within the confines of your resources. If you master those three things, I think that leads to innovative results or innovative ideas and projects.
That's great advice. So, and what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
It's those calls that I have, the one-to-one video calls. Yeah, it's so funny. It's from tiny little words that I use in my marketing, like the word refreshing that I use everywhere in my marketing. That came out of a listener call, all the way up to big ideas like new shows I should launch or new clients or contacts that I now have. So the calls themselves are not scalable, but the lessons I learn from those calls absolutely are.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. And it, in some ways, it ties back with what we've just been talking about on podcasts, because spending 45 minutes with my audience is fabulous and provides, you know, great value. But it's also spending 45 minutes with a guest like you, where I learn so much. It's like having a masterclass.
Yeah, I mean, I would even take, maybe you do this already, but I would even take the opportunity to be the guest once in a while yourself, answer people's questions from the listenership or talk to them directly. Because the more you do that, I think the more that benefit grows.
Hmm. Hmm. Great idea. All right. What's your favorite tool or system for improving your own productivity and allowing you to be more creative?
Oh my goodness. I totally jump around there, but I think right now, my lack of focus is hurting me because I have multiple projects plus the book that I'm writing. So I have an app that I use and it's called Self Control App. Mm-hmm. And you add a bunch of URLs that you want to stop visiting mindlessly as a distraction. You know, for me, it's ESPN and Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook, et cetera. And so you put in those URLs, you punch in the number of minutes you want to do deep work and you hit start. And every time you go to those URLs, it says they cannot be reached. And at first, so weird, but at first, your first thought when you go to those URLs and that mindless habit of yours is to say, oh my gosh, is Twitter down? And then you go to your email, you're like, wait, is Gmail down? And then you're like, oh wait, I can't recognize my own bad habits. So it's an app that has been pretty transformative, I think.
Yeah, I love that because it's a, my first response was, well, you know, you need to develop discipline to keep focus, but we all do distraction and it's like a trigger. It's saying, hang on, you're doing distraction again. And then you can deal with why am I doing distraction as opposed to kind of unconsciously just drift into email or Twitter or whatever it might be.
Right. Right. Yeah. My wife has a doctorate in clinical psychology. And so she's a professional at this. She understands that I am not mindful enough when I'm doing my work because I have too many tabs open and my phone out and alerts everywhere. So this app helps me be more mindful, get rid of that bad habit and focus on, you know, deep and meaningful work.
Love it. All right. What's the best way to keep a project on track?
Oh man, for me, it's just about finding the interestingness and excitement in it. If I find that I'm getting bored with something, I tend to just avoid it like the plague. So it's almost like a game I play. It's I want to, you know, have the mission and the big why or the mountain peak in the distance that I'm going for. And that bigness or that excitement gets me going through all the little moments. So, you know, I think it's that plus constantly getting feedback from an audience as affirmation. That's what fuels me as a person. Again, this is self-awareness, but people saying that I'm doing a good job or people praising my work, that's always been fuel for me even before my work started, you know, as a student, for example. So if I have the big mission and I feel like I'm making a difference and I have people saying I'm doing well, those two things tend to push me forward better than any technology can.
Great advice. Yeah. I can empathize with that fully. I mean, the biggest buzz I get is knowing that I've made a difference to somebody. So
right,
having that
right
feedback and getting that affirmation that that's happened and knowing that was what you intended to do to start with, that helps keep you focused.
Yeah, amen.
All right. Now, we have talked a lot about differentiation, but maybe you could give us a one-sentence thing, which is what is the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
So we, rather than differentiate, let's use the word exceptional because I think that's the path to differentiate, right? So when I use that word strategically throughout the book and the show, because I think to be exceptional, you have to find and follow what makes you an exception. So there's the differentiation idea. And, you know, I'm currently trying to tell some stories and come up with a framework for how to do that. But the simple switch I'd ask people to make is to care less about what the expert says and stop trying to act like experts yourself, because they deal in generalities or absolutes. It's close enough for your situation. That's not how you differentiate. That's not how you do great work. Instead, act like an investigator. Ask the right questions in your situation to root out details you can use in your work. I mentioned Death Wish as a good example, but that's the principle of my show and my book. If people want more stories, it's how to act like an investigator in the digital age to find your own answers in a world overflowing with everybody else's.
Great advice. I love that word exceptional. I use it a lot in my content. I talk about delivering exceptional value and so yeah, being exceptional certainly differentiates you. And I love the idea of the curiosity, having that insatiable curiosity, figuring out why can't that work or why does this work the way it does? Or what can I learn from this that is a totally unrelated area, which we've talked a little bit about modeling earlier on, but I love to look at things that happen in nature and say, well, what can I learn about that? What could that be a metaphor for, which often brings new ideas in as well.
I love that, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us then a little bit about the book Break the Wheel, because obviously that's coming up in the future. When's that due out?
Yeah, so that's due out this fall. And the concept is very similar to this whole conversation. I mean, what I'm trying to do is, you know, make thinking for yourself, make intuition, make, you know, questioning conventional thinking, all these things that people talk about doing when they're a quote innovator or thought leader or success story, you know, that stuff doesn't seem as practical or as usable as a list of tips and tricks. And I want to make it seem as practical. I want to make it seem more logical to take the unconventional path because it's the right path for you. And so I talk about this divide in our work, and I think we all experience this, or this gap between the work we aspire to do and the work we're actually doing, or the results and fulfillment we want to get and the results and fulfillment we have today. And our usual attempts to close that gap are to look for best practices. But those are generalities. They're what works on average, but we don't want to be average. They're what works in general, but we don't operate in a generality. And so to get the rest of the way, that's on you. And so if I can provide some stories from my show and elsewhere, and I can provide the right questions you can ask to do the type of work they did, to me, that's a win, because then you break this endless wheel we're on of like all of these new best practices and trends and tips and tricks and cheats and hacks. And it's just, they're all spokes on a wheel that leads nowhere. And so I want to make thinking for yourself seem just as practical as the conventional thinking.
Sounds great. So I'll check to see if there's a link. Is it got a link to pre-release in Amazon?
No, it's not currently up on Amazon yet. It's too far out. But okay. The best way to keep in touch is you can go to unthinkablemedia.com and just scroll all the way down and join the newsletter there, because okay. That's where I'm sharing. I'm actually sharing almost everything. I've shared snippets from the early drafts. I've shared early versions of the cover. I'm sort of building this book in public with the community. And then eventually I'll offer things like pre-sales and discounts to that newsletter.
And following your own advice in terms of getting feedback and concern, taking that feedback on board to deliver an exceptional product.
The moment before we set up this interview, I tweeted out a poll for help trying to determine my subtitle. So it's, you know, I'm trying to, yeah, practice what I preach.
Love it. All right. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner that wants to be a leader in innovation?
Just because it's the best approach for someone else doesn't make it the best approach for you. We spend too much time biasing our decision-making based on whatever is most common or whatever is most recent. But doing whatever is most common or whatever is most recent doesn't guarantee it's whatever works best for you. And I think we need to be a little bit more self-assured that we understand ourselves, we understand our customers, and we understand the limitations of our own resources to make that call. This whole journey for me started with content marketing being full of copycats. And I just got to the root of the problem, which is we don't know what we're trying to do. We don't know our own context well enough. And so we end up looking to what's worked in the past, what's been most common, what's most recent. So, you know, someone once told me, like, what would work best for you? What would make you happiest in your career? I think that type of question applies in everything you're doing, from the smallest decisions all the way up to global organizations trying to innovate.
That's great. Work out what works best for you and follow that path. All right.
That's all that matters. That's all there is.
Thanks, Jay. This has been really awesome. I really enjoyed this. Where can people reach out and say thank you for what you've shared today?
Oh, I'm all over the internet. People can reach me via email very easily too. It's just jay@unthinkablemedia.com. But anywhere there's a social profile, I tend to be there.
Okay. And we'll have links to some of the things that we've talked about, that article on the new marketing mandate, the Unthinkable Media website, and your Twitter profile as well, so people can perhaps even participate in the poll that you've put up there about the subtitle for the book.
Yeah, that'd be great. And if not, I'm sure there's other things I'm going to try to get people involved in. And if you have listened all the way, speaking of holding attention, if I held your attention today, I'm really glad. And thank you for listening this long. So I'm addressing the listener here. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. And finally, then, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
Oh, man, this is the hard question, right? have you talked to Andrew Davis yet?
No, I haven't.
Andrew Davis is a mentor of mine who taught me quite a bit about the public speaking industry, and he's also a brilliant showmaker in his own right. And he's currently creating a video series that is, to me, unparalleled in both quality and insight, called The Loyalty Loop on YouTube. So if you search for Andrew Davis Loyalty Loop, if you're listening, you'll find his show. It's incredible. But he's a marketing speaker and author. He's sold an agency. He's worked for the Muppets and the news. And like, he's an embarrassment of riches when it comes to his intellect, his story, and his warmth.
Sounds like a fabulous guest. So Andrew, if you happen to be listening to this, look out for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Jay Kunzo. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, Jay. I've really enjoyed it. I've made heaps of notes here. I'm going to go back and listen to it and pick up some, because I did pick up some ideas for some of the things that we're doing here at InnovaBiz. And I've really enjoyed this, and I hope the audience get a lot out of this as well.
I hope so too. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And again, to the listener, thanks for paying attention to all my my ideas, and I hope to see it somewhere on the internet.
Yeah, I wish you all the best for the future and for the launch of the book, which we'll keep a lookout for, and let's keep in touch.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Bye.
Wasn't that fun and totally awesome? There was just so much in that interview to learn from, and I've got pages of notes for my own benefit. I hope you enjoyed it too and got value from that conversation with Jay. All the ideas and tips that Jay shared with us can be found at innovabiz.co/Jay Acunzo. That is JayAcunzo. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Jay Acunzo. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Jay there, as well as links to his website, to the new marketing mandate article we talked about, and to both of his podcasts, the Unthinkable Podcast and the Maker Channel. Jay suggested I interview Andrew Davis, creator of the Loyalty Loop, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Andrew, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Jay Acunzo. Stay connected. Head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you make sure you'll never miss another episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions or questions, share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. It's free to join. Hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.